Major Hun, Reel 11, you were giving me a sort of estimate of how much ground you could cover if you had good weather.
Yes. Well, on one of these, just short air, within a couple of days, I think, of being in this situation where we were fired down by the anti-tank gun, we were still escorting or doing the right flank protection for the division. And we drove into a not a body, an open patch with an escarpment in front of us. And as we drew up, we could see an anti-tank gun on the top of this escarpment. And we could quite clearly see the gun through the binoculars. And so the deal was, we drove and we turned round, turned the turrets to face the enemy. But with that, again, Matt Abraham in the middle, me on his right. No, and as we went along, I was on his left, and the other's car was on his right. And as we turned, and I said to Maggie, well, I gave him instructions to fire with the Beezer, the big Beezer.
The point .5?
Yes, because I thought the range would be better to take on the anti-tank gun. And I'd just given an order to fire, and I saw the flash of the gun. That fired. And it aimed at Matt Abraham in the middle. And so straight away I fired smoke to give protection for him. And carried on firing. And started to withdraw to get out of range, you see. And then got down in the turret, get some smoke, leave them and put some more smoke in, and eventually got back out of range. And got to Matt Abraham's car, and he was very fortunate, he'd been hit underneath somehow, whether it hit the ground and ricocheted up, and his transfer box was holed.
Was that the
for the gears and for
yes.
the holding the oil and well, it's a sump like thing under, which is the transfer box anyway.
Underneath the rear axle.
Yes. And but he got out away, so I walked over to him and saw the damage. And we got on the radio, so we want assistance to get that vehicle out. And whilst I was over there, my gunner came over and said, come and look at this. So I walked back to my own car. And there, where my tubular cover was up at the back, you know, you have one in front and one at the back. Dead in the middle of the tubular in the padding was a bullet hole. Right where my head
would be.
So I think when I went down to get smoke discharges to put in to replace them, it must have been when they were machine gunning at the same time. Must have gone in there. So I thought myself, my God, that's just lucky.
Yeah.
And anyway, we got
the bullets had gone through the hatch covers then.
The padding.
Yes.
The padding of it, and that was the hole right in the middle. So, yeah, it was. I hadn't noticed it at the time, but my gunner from everywhere saw it. So we got Bob Glass, who was the sergeant fitter. He got another, he cannibalised some other vehicle and caught it up and got that spot over him.
How long did it take him to turn up?
It didn't take very long because the echelon, the forward echelon, was only a few mile back. And the main rear echelon was even, you know, I'd say 20 mile, probably might be 10 mile, and so on. So it might have been about 10 mile back. And so he could come up fairly quickly once, you'd give a couple of hours or something like that. So he came up and did the repair. And of course, we went back on our way. And there was something that happened, and some Italian Mackie fighters came over and attacked us. And they were machine gunning us, and you could hear that. Luckily, they didn't have those rockets or anything like that in those days. But from the range they were shooting, it was hitting the car, but it wasn't piercing it. And it was just, you know, you could hear like sledgehammers on the side of the thing as they'd been hit. But we could fire back at them because they were coming in low and they came around twice. But we could then get our guns at the same level and put up a good.
What sort of, what numbers of them were there?
There were three.
Three of them?
Mm.
And how many armoured cars?
Three.
So it's three against three?
Yeah, yeah. But, I don't think the other car was hit. Mm. It was only mine, and I think Matt got his as well, but the other one, because we were spread out, they sort of came on one.
So. Did they do any damage?
Not really, apart from the water cans.
Yes.
And the bedding. And the outside bins, you know, which sort of the rations, you know, we find the sugar all over the bottom of the bin and things like that. But other than that,
I'd imagine the tyres might have been vulnerable to a machine gun fire.
You could run about 50 miles on a tyre when it had been hit.
Oh, right.
You know, so they were run flat, you know, so it didn't bother us a lot. And we always, there was a spare on the front of the. On the front of the vehicle as well, which we could always use if necessary.
Do you think you scored any hits on the aircraft?
I don't think so. We might have done, but you can't tell. Certainly we didn't shoot it down.
Mm.
It's a case of, it was good for morale to shoot back. And it probably might, if they could see the tracer going, it would deter them a bit, you see.
Now, working on the flat open desert like this with very long distances, it sounds a great contrast to what you'd done earlier on in 1940 in France and Belgium.
Yes.
Were you able to find cover in the desert?
No.
So you couldn't really observe without being seen yourself?
No, you always had to be seen. Mm. And so therefore you were always open to being shelled.
Yes.
But it was good for the desert because you could. You had room to manoeuvre, you could get out of it, you had the space.
So you had to use speed rather than cover as protection.
And your smoke, which was always a thing that we used if we were under attack.
Could you use any sort of camouflage measures to disguise yourselves?
No, not really. No, because if you've got a flat surface, no matter, you're going to stick up there.
Mm.
You know, if there's anyone there with the binoculars or you've got looking to hear, well, it's something there.
Mm.
Even a man standing up and spotting, see.
Roughly how far could you see on a good day, you know, with clear?
I should say a couple of miles easily.
Mm.
Probably more, you know. Then that would be a bit of haze.
Yes. But would that be heat haze?
Heat haze, yes.
And what would you be looking for, usually?
Any movement.
Movement.
If there was movement, you'd spot on that, and then you'd try, you couldn't see it pop, and then you'd move a bit closer till you could see exactly what it was.
Mm.
But again, you had to be very careful that you knew the range, if it was going to be a tank or an anti-tank gun, you know, the range, you've got to think, well, I'm going to get too close if you want to observe. And if you did get too close and they fired, then straight away you'd revert to fight some bombs away.
Just to fight another day.
Yes.
But of course, anti-tank guns could be static, and they're quite small, aren't they?
Yes.
Compared to tanks, rather.
They could be dug down a bit.
Yes.
So they're just sort of the barrel is just above the surface.
Mm.
And there could be the odd place where there is a foliage in the ground. Certainly.
Yes.
In certain parts of the desert, I mean, the desert varies too much. You see, one day you'd be on lovely sand and flat and that, and then there'd be stone and rock. Mm. And then you might come somewhere where there's a wadi. So it varied quite a bit. I know In another place, but just after this, we were going along, and it was just like sand dunes. And we were in a sort of an area that's based off sand, and we could hear all this transport going on very close, and we could see it. But we couldn't do anything, we couldn't attack it, because, you know, we weren't strong enough to attack it. So we had to keep still and let all this transport go through, you know, probably always protected anyway by a tank or something. So, and we just had to sort of let it go and then report it, which was our job to report it. And just afterwards, the same day, a bit of a sandstorm came up, and we saw one of these big lorries with a big canopy on, out on its own, on a sort of rise. And you go, right, well, we have this. And then you think, well, what they used to have was a lorry with a canopy over it. But when the canopy dropped, there'd be an anti-tank gun on board. And they used to use this system quite a lot, where you'd be lured onto something, and when you were close enough, bang, you'd get it.
It's rather like the Q-ship system.
So we saw this, and we thought, right, we'll be very careful here. And Matt went in the middle, I went on one flank, and Corbin went on the other, so we could come from all directions. But with the orders to the gunners, as soon as that canopy drops, you shoot. So he crept up on this, everybody was all alert, ready to shoot, you know. And eventually, when we got close enough, there was some poor little Italian driver with his hands up. You know, he'd been left behind with this great big lorry. So he was our first prisoner.
What did you do with him?
Well, we kept him for a bit, and we sent him back to regiment headquarters, and the guy would use him as his backman for about a week or so, and he was quite happy.
What did he have in his truck?
Nothing.
It was empty?
Yeah, we were hoping it might be full of rations or something, but nothing else or something. But we got something later.
Did you destroy the truck?
No, no. You just left it where it was, because we were coming out anyway.
Right.
So there's no point in attracting
any attention.
And then we went up onto a pass at Skilladima, I think the name of the pass was, and it went down to an airfield at Suluk. And this airfield, as we went down, there was four troop and three troop, which was John Clark Kennedy's troop. And as we went down onto the airfield, I saw a truck shoot out from the far side of it and race down towards the, on the track, which would lead to the coast road at Gimimes. And the enemy were retreating from Benghazi down south and to Sirte, you know, on that coast road. So our troop chased it down the road and firing at it as long as I tried. And occasionally I told the driver to stop so the gun could get a good view. And we saw at one stage the driver get out. The passenger get out and the young man on the driver's side and get in, so I think the driver might have been hit.
Yeah.
And we carried on and did that shot off. And then we came up to a rise. And as we went over the rise, the truck disappeared over the rise and we came up over. And as we came up over, there was the whole of, I think, the German army going down the coast road, 300 or 400 yards away, might have been closer. And just we got a shot, you see. So we, Matt Abraham and I, we just stopped and just said, fire. You know, just told the gunner to shoot anybody he liked. You could see the targets. There were these great big wire spans and all sorts in front of us. And he couldn't miss. So both of us were shooting away at that, you know, for 30 minutes, I think.
Did any fire come back from the convoy on the road?
Then suddenly everything opened up. Mm. By then, German anti-tank gunners had got organised, you see. Mm. They started showing us, you see, and stuff was coming, you know, but that's really heavy. So we, again, put in the smoke, fired off the smoke, the explosions were coming all around then.
Yes.
And so we had smoke, then we had to lean out and put some more smoke in. That's when and I object to doing smoke when you're to expose the shell fire like that. And we got dropped back over the hill, below the dead ground. And Matt said, I'm going back. So I pulled up closer and see whether we could run. He said, I'm going back to some guy. He said, Corporal Prime, he's not with us. He's lost him up there. So I said, you haven't. He's not up there. I said, just here. I said, you're not. And I argued with him for a while. I said, he didn't come up with us. It was only you and I up there. And in fact, Prime was back about half a mile.
What was he doing while you were going forward?
He should have been with us, he said.
Yes.
But he wasn't very reliable. And he said his camouflage light had fallen off, he had stopped to put it back on again.
Right.
So, in fact, just Matt and I were there. So we came back and we thought, well, we could pull back a bit now, away from this area, because we could be easy targets. And as we were back, one of C Squadron troops came along, and that was commanded by Robert Buckman. Later commanded the regiment as a major general. He was a very good troop leader of the Sea Squadron. And he said to him, you go up there, anti tank guns. And he said, Windy B Squadron. So, and off he went. About 3 minutes later, we heard a bang, and back he came with a hole in his side. So he hadn't met up with the anti tank guns.
Did the Germans attempt to follow you up when you withdrew over the crest?
No. Well, I think they sent out a screen, to protect.
Yes.
And that was what he ran into.
So he ran into a flank guard and he came over the top.
That's right. So that was a bit exciting. Of course, when I came back, I found that one of the things the lorry had dropped off on the way was a box containing tins of jam, which came in very good, shared amongst the squadron.
German rations or Italian rations? Italian.
Apricot jam and some tins of condensed milk. It worked out that each troop in the squadron shared it with them, got about 3 or 4 tins each, which was quite a bonus for them.
Useful. When you were doing your reconnoitring and screening, did you ever encounter the enemy's reconnaissance and screening forces?
Yes, you used to come up now and again with a 8-wheel armed camera. But that would shoot at you, but it was again, their orders were obviously the same as ours, they never sort of came to attack us.
Did they use the same kind of techniques as you used? Tactical procedures and so on.
As I say, you could see them, and they could see us observing, and that was the same sort of thing that they would.
How close would they get to you?
I think within firing range. I think they had a better gun than us.
Well, the 8-wheeled armoured car had.
Yes.
Didn't they have
20 millimetre, was it?
Well, so I think they had a range of calibres. They had a cannon of some sort on them.
Yeah, I think a 20mm, which would outrange ours. So we would always make sure we'd keep out of range of them. But they didn't chase us or anything like that.
Did you manage to find ways through their screen to do your recce's?
Oh, it's, well, not really. The thing was, they would be dropping back.
Yes.
We would be advancing. And if they want to hold us up a bit more, they put a tank in there.
Yeah.
You see. We did get behind the screen a couple of times. And that was later when we got to further south near Surtee, which I'll tell you about in a while.
Did you do any reconnaissance work at night?
No. I know at night we were coming back from one patrol, and we normally used to meet up to perform close leader with the squadron leader. And he'd give us a map reference, and sometimes if you weren't sure where it was, he'd put up a flare, or red over white, or we'd have an arrangement. Because sometimes Germany would put up a signal.
Yes.
So we'd have to have a certain
combination of colours.
To do that. And I know one night we were going along, and there was six armoured cars. There was Matt Abraham and John Clark Kennedy, and then I was behind Matt, and then the troop corporal, and John Clark Kennedy, Oscar Pearson, and his troop corporal, and we were going along in the dark, almost touching. It was pitch dark, you couldn't see anything at all. Certainly from the top. Ground level, you can, as we all see, a bit more than that there, you couldn't see much. And we were going along to find our troop, our squadron leader. And I think John either wanted to spend a penny, because we stopped, and he got out. And as he got out, he heard a bolt click. And as he looked ahead, there was a black mass. And he thought, well, now is that German or is that ours? So we decided we would swing round. We all swung round the same way as we started to turn. The guns were there. And there was green tracer, green and white tracer, which is obviously the German tracer, was coming all around. Unfortunately, we all turned the right direction to get away. And these things were coming all around us. And not one of us was hit. And that wasn't until the next morning that I realised I had been hit. And it was something. Something must have hit underneath and hit my radiator, shot through somehow, and hit the radiator, so I had
a leak.
So I said to my corporal, right, you take my car, take it to the workshop, have it fixed, I'll take over your car, and leave all the kit on, don't bother changing them. I'll meet you when we come back tonight, and we'll swap back again. You see? So he said, okay, that's all right, yeah. He's quite happy. But I didn't, I knew we were going on patrol, and I didn't want to miss it. And I knew that Matt wanted him with him. So off he went on patrol. And we were watching a stretch, but again, we were all about the wide area we were covering, and there was a troop on the right, I think either two or three armoured cars, and then we were in the middle with Matt and I. Matt was on my right, I was on the left, and there was another troop over on the far left. Again, a good wide space between each, and we were watching, and quite fairly quiet. And then the supply lorry came along, our supply lorry, and what we used to do was to get into the far end, at one end, it'd go to one armoured car, supplier, it'd be passed on to the next or under. And so it'd come right along the
Whole line.
The line, which gives us what we wanted, and then it'd finish up there and then go back. That would give my chap name Wilkes, Charlie Wilkes. And he was the windiest man in the squadron. Obviously, because he's on a 90,000 gallon of petrol, high octane, ammunition, all on board his lorry.
And you had to go right up to the front.
Yeah, he had no protection, you know, bombing, shelling, he was there, terrible job. And he's the only one in the squadron who wore a steel helmet. So everyone used to think that he was windy, they weren't in his position. But anyway, he was at the far end, replenishing. Paul was simply over a mile away from us, well over a mile, probably not even 2 miles. And in front of us appeared 27 tanks, big ones, dead in front. Oh, Matt and I looked, oh God. So on the radio straight away, back to squadron headquarters, reporting in the tanks and what they were, Mark 3s, Mark 4s and whatnot.
How were they laid out?
They were more or less spread about a bit. Not in close formation, but
were they in line abreast, or were they
more or less, probably a bit like a square. But they weren't bothering us. They'd stopped, and they weren't shooting at us. They thought, well, why did we bother? We didn't want to bother with them. End up doing us any harm. What they wanted to do, I didn't know. But they didn't want to get involved with us.
How close did they get to you before they stopped?
A couple of thousand yards, I'd say. Not even a bit more.
And you had, would you normally have, in a troop, would you normally have 2 cars forward and 1 car back?
No.
You'd have all 3 cars in line.
In line, yeah.
Maximum coverage, in other words.
Right, yes.
So you'd had no depth to your screen.
And in any way, we only had 2 armoured cars in the troop.
Yes, because your corporal had gone back.
But we would have still lengthened the line. So we reported this back to Cornelia. He reported back to the army officer. And back came the message for us: be aggressive. Be aggressive. 2 beaters at each. Field 3 and a 0.5 with 27 tanks in front. So anyway, we showed Willie, we moved forward and we fired. And next minute, zoom, they opened up at us. And we turned and we went back. And we were, shells were coming past our ears and exploding all over the place. And we were going back at later knots. And then I had Jock Main, who was the driver, which has Weezing, and Taffy Roberts is the gunner. They're not my gunners, but they were.
They were the corporals.
They were good, they were nice, because I had them on my car before John Newman. And we were going, and I said to Jock Main, zigzag! Zigzagging, and I didn't want to get a line on me. Fire and smoke and shells were coming by, and I said to Taffy Roberts, who was next to me in the tunnel, so one of these will hit us in a minute, and then suddenly our drop man stopped. He said, can't go, we've been hit somewhere, but can't go. So I said, alright, bail out. So we bailed out, got the maps and everything, and started running. I got on the radio first. I told them about that. I got on the radio and said to Matt, I've been hit. Can you come get me out? But unfortunately, he was running like the hammers, and he was on the other set, and I was on the troop set.
And he was on the squadron there.
He was on the squadron there, you see, so therefore he didn't hear what I said.
Yes.
So I started running. There was the 3 hours running, and the shells were still dropping. And out of the blue, And of course, all the other troops started withdrawing and the tanks started moving.
And the tanks were following you up, were they?
Yeah. Not to a great bit, but they had moved a bit, so until the others started going back in line with us, you see. And out of the blue, this Westerner or this Pepperell had been told to get out.